Are you looking for a podcast that's on the cutting edge of what's new and exciting on the internet? A podcast for users about the things that matter to them? The Global Geek Podcast is this and more. A podcast about the latest technology news, reviews and interviews, applications and programs to make life easier, sites and services that are useful, fun, productive or just plain interesting. Not forgetting the Get Chicken segment. Presented by two hosts on opposite sides of the globe. We really are the Global Geek Podcast. Find us at www.globalgeekpodcast.com on the podcast network. Two hemispheres, two geeks, one podcast.
Air Breaker 19, this is Rubber Duck. You got a copy on me, Big Ben, come on.
Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. The big orange widget in my Vista sidebar says that it's March 21st, 2007. And the little clock has disappeared. Where the hell did the clock go? Must have disappeared when I put the iTunes widget in. Anyway, that's not what I'm here to talk about, although I did do a big blog post this afternoon on Windows Vista. I like it. Is it revolutionary? Nah. But it's very pretty. And there's nothing wrong with pretty. As somebody said to me today, I won't mention any names, I was talking to a friend today and he was talking about another guy's wife. And he was talking about how impressive this woman is. He said, man, she's really smart, really switched on, really down to earth, very attractive as well. And he said then, you know, that's not everything, but, gee, what did he say? Oh, no, I can't remember the punchline. Damn. It was pretty funny, though. It was something like, you know, it's not everything, but you have high aspirations or something. Anyway, what I wanted to talk about tonight, this is just me, no interviews, no guests, nothing. And it's going to be very quick, I promise you, because I've got to go play some Black on the Xbox. I'm obsessed with Black at the moment. I was up to like 4 o'clock this morning playing Black. But because I was trying to de-stress from the technical challenges that we've had at TPN this week, which hopefully most of you wouldn't have noticed, but behind the scenes, lots of stuff going on with plugins not doing what we thought they were going to do. But anyway, I've had a few people in the course of the last few weeks, friends of the show, friends of TPN, friends of the cam, contact me in a variety of ways and say, you know, this whole thing you've got about religion and Christians, it's not doing you any favours. And I'm like, well, what do you mean? And they're like, well, you know, you're just alienating people, or, you know, you're too aggressive in your position on it, and, you know, you're probably not doing yourself any favours, is sort of the line. And whilst I'm sure they're probably right, I'm sure that challenging something as mainstream as Christianity or religion or faith is probably going to upset or annoy or alienate some people. And maybe it's my style, but you know what? It kind of is what it is. You know, here's the thing. Here's the question that I ask myself. Why do I do this show? Why do I podcast? Is it because I want to make you happy? No, not so much. Is it because I want to be the most popular podcaster on the planet? No. Is it to make money? No, not really. There's plenty of things I could do where I'd probably make more money. It's, you know, it's really for me, my personal show, this show, about having an outlet, being able to communicate the things that I'm thinking about. And even if there's just one other person listening, if you live in Melbourne, let's get together and have a coffee. I'll stop recording. If there's a handful of people, you know, it's about getting this stuff out there and seeing what people think. It's about creating some dialogue, some conversation, some debate. Now, somebody, a good friend of mine, said to me yesterday, well, you know what, you're so, these probably aren't his words, but he said something like, Cameron, you're being so antagonistic in the way that you present this stuff that the people whose minds you want to change aren't going to engage you in debate. You should be, what did he mean? He was basically suggesting that I should change my approach, keep talking about this stuff, but change my approach so it's not as antagonistic. And you know what? He's probably absolutely right. I'm sure that I would get a much better response if I was a better politician. But, you know, after many, many years of thinking about this and many years of seeing a therapist, I've come to the conclusion that I am the way I am. I'm very direct. I'm very blunt. I come across as being antagonistic and arrogant when I say things bluntly and directly. And yeah, look, I've read enough How to Win Friends and Influence Dale Carnegie style books to know that if I really wanted to, I could probably change that. You know, there are times in my life where I do curb what I say because of the situation, obviously. But that's not what this show is about. I don't want to do that on this show. Yeah, this show has gone through various phases, obviously, over the last couple of years that I've been doing it. We've changed formats, we've changed co-hosts, we've changed all focuses. You know, somebody was saying on the forums recently, get off the religion thing and get back to technology. I listen to G'day World because it's all about, I want to hear about new technology. Well, that's kind of not what this show's about and never was about. I mean, we may have talked about technology a lot in the early days, but we also talked about a lot of other things. It's always just been a place for me to have a chat, you know, and have a conversation with some potentially like-minded people. And even though I know that not all of the audience agrees with me on lots of things, it's about a conversation, it's about dialogue. And if I start filtering that conversation, or if I start changing the way that I deliver it, it's not going to be real. Which kind of reminds me of this book that I'm reading. I mentioned on the show the other day, this book, Mediated. It's fabulous. Really thoroughly enjoying it. And, you know, one of the points that he's making in the book is that when we live our lives today, we are all playing a role more than ever before. Actually, he starts off the book with this great example. He talks about in the early 60s, he was studying acting. He was in a method acting class one morning in 1963 when all the students were hanging around sort of waiting for their teacher. The door flew open and one of the teachers in this building said, "The president's just been shot," and slammed the door and ran out. And this guy's saying, somebody in the student body said, "It's we're supposed to what do they call it? Innovate. Damn. What do you call it when you make stuff up? You play jazz and you when you play music and you make it up as you go along." I'm having a mental blank. Just pause. I'm going to pause the show and go look that word. Yeah, improvisation. Didn't I say that? Yeah, they had to improvise. And so innovate, I said, improvise. He said, it's an improvisation thing. So they all started improvising how they would be feeling if the president had been shot. And he talks about how some were very dark and moody and brooding and others were in fits of hysteria. And this went on for about 15 minutes. And they thought they were secretly being watched by a teacher. And then another student who arrived late and had heard the actual news came in and saw what was going on and figured it out and said, no, the president's really been shot and he's really dead. And the author of the book, Zengadita, he says, there was this really uncomfortable moment when everyone realized that they had been method acting this thing, but it was really real. And then they didn't know what to do. How should they respond? I mean, after you've just been pretending a response, is it then valid for you to give the same response in the real situation? Anyway, he goes on to say that we have been so conditioned by television, movies, etc. in the last 50 years that every situation we are presented with in our life, we have seen on TV, in films, over and over and over again, and it's gone into our subconscious. And we know what it is that we're supposed to do or say or act in these situations. We're still being real, but our being real has sort of been invented by other people. And that we are at some level always conscious of the fact that, for example, if I'm in a situation with my kids and I'm trying to discipline my kids, as I'm disciplining my kids, somewhere in the back of my head, not only am I playing out the conditioning of my childhood and my parents, but I have all of these inputs from every television show and every film I've ever seen where a parent is disciplining a kid. And, you know, these are all adding to my method acting in the situation. Anyway, it's a much deeper subject than that, something that I'm not... I haven't read this book enough yet to really be able to talk you through it eloquently, but I highly recommend it if you're interested in the way that the media is affecting us and has affected us. But the thing I was thinking about while I was reading this is that when I'm on this show, you know, I've got up on my soapbox a lot over the last couple of years and talked about how mainstream media is false and it's artificial. But then I think about this show, and whilst, you know, going back to what I said earlier on, how I don't want to deliberately or consciously change my approach to these things, I just want it to flow naturally for me to be who I am, for good or for bad. You know, I realize that when I do this show, I'm not really, really being me. You know, this is a version of me, I guess. Like, I don't tell you guys everything that's really going on in my life. You don't know the intimate details of what's happening in my personal life, the ups and downs, or my business, or any of that. I might give you glimpses of it from time to time, but I'm not willing to be completely transparent about all that stuff. Not really to protect myself. It's mostly to protect other people that are involved in it. So I have to hold back stuff. And so what does that mean? Does that mean that I'm not being real, that this is another form of artifice? Is this another form of media where I'm pretending to be real, but I'm not, like scripted reality TV? I remember one of my sisters, Anita, was on a reality TV show, kind of a challengey quiz type of bullshit show on Channel 7 called Dog Eat Dog several years ago. And there was this thing where you had a bunch of contestants and they had to outperform each other and then vote each other off and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, I know that she talks about how in their sort of rehearsal, she had decided to be like the bitchy woman of the group. And, you know, that she was performing when she was on cameras. It was supposed to be real, but she knew, you know, tonight Anita Riley is performing the role of the bitch of the group. Just outed my sister there. Doesn't matter, she never listens to the show, so she won't know. But I don't know, it's been concerning me over the last couple of days. How much of this show is real and how much of it isn't real? And when people suggest that I should sort of curb my approach, I worry about that. You know, and I think one of the challenges with building a business around podcasting is as you get a bigger audience and you get some advertisers or you get investors and there's a lot of other things riding on it than just you, the tendency will be to curb a lot of that kind of stuff, to be more politically correct and to, you know, not say anything that could upset advertisers or investors or cause problems. But, you know, this is part of the journey that we're on as members of the new media. I hate that term. I hate citizen media as well. What do you think? Something else I was going to talk about tonight. What was that going to be? Loving my new PC. Have I mentioned that? Ooh, yeah. I'm going to pause this and check my blog. Oh yeah, Buckminster Fuller. So let me talk to you a little bit about Bucky Fuller. I have been meaning to get into Bucky Fuller for years and years and years. And for some reason, just never went out there and bought the books until recently. Although, as I started to become interested again in him recently through a number of conversations I was having, particularly with Peter Elliott, I spent like a couple of days scouring my library because I was quite convinced that at one stage I'd gone out there and bought a couple of books on Bucky Fuller, but I couldn't find them, so I mustn't have. So let me tell you a little bit about Buckminster Fuller. For those of you who aren't familiar with him and or his work, Richard Buckminster, a.k.a. Bucky Fuller, born in 1895, died in 1983. He was an American visionary, designer, architect, poet, author, and inventor. I'm reading this from Wikipedia, obviously. Yes, John, I'm reading it from Wikipedia. Get over it. I figure, you know, I could tell you what I think about this stuff, but why not, you know, a lot of time and effort has gone into getting these things in Wikipedia right. I might as well just quote from that. It's much more eloquent than anything I'm going to come up with. Throughout his life, Fuller was concerned with the question, does humanity have a chance to survive lastingly and successfully on planet Earth, and if so, how? Considering himself an average individual without special monetary means or academic degree, he chose to devote his life to this question, trying to find out what an individual like him could do to improve humanity's condition that large organizations, governments, or private enterprises inherently could not do. Pursuing this lifelong experiment, Fuller wrote 28 books, coining and popularizing terms such as spaceship Earth, ephemeralization, and synergetics. He also worked in the development of numerous inventions, chiefly in the fields of design and architecture, the best known of which is the geodesic dome. Now, here's some interesting stuff. This is his background, right? He was born in Milton, Massachusetts, the grandnephew of American transcendentalist Margaret Fuller. The Fuller family, in particular, produced noted New England nonconformists. Buckminster Fuller's father died when the boy was 12. Spending his youth on Bear Island off the coast of Maine, he was a boy with a natural propensity for design and for making things. He often made things from materials he brought home from the woods, and he even sometimes made his own tools. Then he goes off to Milton Academy. He starts studying at Harvard. He gets expelled from the university twice, the first time for entertaining an entire dance troupe, and second for his irresponsibility and lack of interest. By his own appraisal, he was a non-conforming misfit in the fraternity environment. Later in life, he received an SCD, a Diploma of Science, I guess, from Bates College in 1969. Now, between his sessions at Harvard, he worked for a time in Canada as a mechanic in a textile mill, later as a laborer working 12 hours a day in the meatpacking industry. Then he served in the U.S. Navy in World War I as a radio operator, then as the editor of a publication, and then finally as a crash boat commander. He was discharged, worked again in the meatpacking business, acquired some management experience. And then in the early 1920s, he and his father-in-law developed the Stockade building system for producing lightweight, weatherproof, and fireproof housing, but the company failed. Now, in 1927, at the age of 32, bankrupt and jobless, living in inferior housing in Chicago, Illinois, he saw his beloved young daughter, Alexandra, die of the complications of polio and spinal meningitis. He felt responsible, and this drove him to drink and to the verge of suicide. However, at the last moment, he decided instead to embark on, and this is in inverted commas, an experiment to find what a single individual can contribute to changing the world and benefiting all humanity. Let me read that again. This was his experiment. To find out what a single individual can contribute to changing the world and benefiting all humanity. That, and the rest of his life was a fulfillment of that experiment. I mean, what an amazing life ambition or life mission to find out what a single individual can contribute. So he took a position in a small college in North Carolina, and then with some other professors and students, he began work on the geodesic dome. Now, if you don't know what a geodesic dome is, you've probably seen these, no doubt. They're domes, sometimes quite large, although they can be quite small. They're made out of platonic solids, basically. You know, they're crafted from triangles, which make hexagons, and then you attach them all together and you build these domes. In 1949, he erected the world's first geodesic dome building that could sustain its own weight with no practical limits. So these things have no pillars, none of the traditional, you know, infrastructure that you need inside of a building. It was a 14-foot diameter dome constructed using lightweight aluminium aircraft tubing with a vinyl plastic skin in the simple form of a tetrahedron, a triangular pyramid. For the next 50 years, he had a whole range of ideas, a lot of them around practical, inexpensive shelter and transportation. He documented his life, philosophy, and ideas scrupulously in a daily diary, which ended up at the end of his life going over 28 publications. And apparently, he wrote down everything that happened in his life in like 15-minute increments, all day, every day, over 50 years. Imagine that. Mind-boggling. He financed some of his experiments with inherited family money, sometimes augmented by funds invested by his professional collaborators, one example being the Dymaxion car project. Basically, you know, he spent the rest of his life then looking at these sorts of things. He also got very involved in renewable sources of energy, solar and wind-derived electricity. And one of his ambitions was for an age of omni-successful education and sustenance for all humanity. He was really one of the very early thinkers, as you've already heard Peter Elliott say about the sustainable living movement. Now, this is fascinating. This is the end of his life. He died on July 1st, 1983, at the age of 87, a guru of the design, architecture, and alternative communities. His wife was comatose and dying of cancer, and while visiting her in the hospital, he exclaimed at one point, "She is squeezing my hand." He then stood up, suffered a massive heart attack, and died an hour later. His wife died 36 hours later. And he's buried in Boston, Massachusetts. Isn't that an amazing story? The whole deal, just about how at 32, bankrupt, his daughter dies, he starts drinking heavily, he's on the verge of suicide, and he makes a decision to see what he can do with his life, what he can contribute. And to me, that's sort of the key, you know. And I'm not comparing myself to Bucky Fuller by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, one of the defining points for me in the last few years was this idea about what can I contribute. And building the business for me, building TPN, and everything that I do from this point on, it's not about making money. I've said this on the show before, I know. It's not about wealth creation. It's not about who's the richest kid with the best toys. It's not about who can flip to Google and be on the front page of Wired. Now, they are all great things, and if any of those happen, and, you know, I plan for at least some of those things to happen, I reckon I can be on the front page of Wired, and I reckon I can create a lot of wealth for myself and investors and the other hosts and participants and TPN and employees of TPN. I think we have an incredible vehicle here for creating wealth. But that's not the primary motivator for me. It's not what gets me up in the morning. You know, it's an important part of what I need to do to make TPN be successful, but it's not what gets me out of bed. What gets me out of bed is this idea of contribution. What can I contribute? What can I do with my life to make it worthwhile to me, to give it meaning for me? One of the things I've learned about myself in the last few years is that I need to be doing things that have meaning in order to just get through the day. I mean, you know, the 20 years or so I spent in the corporate workforce were just, I don't believe in a soul, but if I did, they would be soul draining. They were life-draining experiences for me. It wasn't all bad. There were some highlights. I met some great people, and I had some great experiences. But really, overall, working inside of a big corporation for me, or even and working in small businesses to a certain extent, were just mind-numbing, destroying experiences. It's just such an artificial existence. It's so far removed from, you know, what humans did for millions of years, you know, hunting and gathering and fighting off the wee beasties. To sit in these artificial concrete and glass blocks in these little IKEA desks and cubicles and creating artificial power structures to give us a feeling of importance and relevance for our lives, when, you know, the thing that most people are working for is just to have superannuation portfolio or enough investment properties and properties in diversified stocks so they can afford to retire at 65 and do all of the things that they really wish they'd been doing for their life. But, you know, statistically, they're probably going to die a month after they retire. I mean, to me, I don't know. I know some people that they're fine with that. They've got no issues with getting up and doing that every day. Me, I couldn't do it, you know. Now, not that I think TPN has really accomplished anything significant in terms of changing people's lives. We do get emails, and by we, I mean the hosts. You know, we get emails from time to time where people say, hey, look, you know, my life has been immeasurably improved by something one of you said on a podcast, or the fact that you're out there and that you think that way or you did this, or whatever, which is great. As I've said to my hosts a bunch of times, if something that you say on a podcast changes one person's life, what a privilege that is. And I think we can actually do that on a massive scale. I think we can change the way that millions of people think and live and evaluate and challenge the world around them, question what's going on around them. But it's a privilege. So let me finish this rather serious episode by saying that whilst I know that I can come across as being antagonistic and I sound arrogant and I'm not politically correct in some of the stuff that I say, and whilst that's not going to change anytime soon, I see podcasting as a privilege. I see the ability for me to reach out and communicate with a large audience as a genuine privilege. And the fact that I can do this day in and day out, I don't have a job, I don't have to go out there and kill a beast or pick fruit to feed my family. You know, I fully recognize that, damn, hundreds of thousands of generations of humans have come before me. Literally billions of human beings have come before me to get me to this place. And they have all, the vast, vast, vast majority of those, literally worked and died, and that was pretty much it. You know, from the time they could walk, they were working, and they worked until they died, and, you know, they scratched out the most meager of livings so I could be here today talking into this microphone, and you could be sitting there with your headphones on, listening. I mean, that's an incredible privilege. You know, there are billions of people that had to do what they did for us to be here with the internet and the iPod and the broadband and enough wealth, middle-class wealth, that we don't need to worry about those basic, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We've got them taken care of. What are we going to do now? What are we going to do with this inheritance that we have received, this comfort? Are we going to squander it by watching Big Brother or worrying about the footy scores for this week? Is that really what you're going to do with this incredible gift that has been bequeathed to you by billions of human beings over millions of years, this gift of comfort, of time, of luxury? Is that what you're going to do with it? Or are you going to find out what one individual can contribute to the benefit of the human race?